Welcome to the Drive Phase Podcast, the best podcast for information on issues surrounding sports business in the Caribbean. On the Drive Phase, we have discussions with sport administrators, coaches, athletes, and various stakeholders in the sporting industry and examine their contribution to sports and entrepreneurship. Here's your host, Dalton Myers.
Thanks as always, Colleen. That's Colleen Dawkins, and I hope you two are doing well. Today, in this episode, I have with me a very talented sportsman. He's an Olympian, as well as a podcaster. Sadly, he's a Manchester United fan, but we'll forgive him for that. He is a Pan American Games silver medalist and Jamaica's first diver at the Olympics, at the Pan American Games, and at the Commonwealth Games. So we'll talk about that in a few. And we're talking about none other than Yona Knight Wisdom. I mean, the good thing for Yona is that he has a cousin who has played for Liverpool. So I think that qualifies him to be on this podcast. Yona, thanks for joining me.
Always comes out to football at the end of the day, doesn't it?
It does. Listen, I hope that you're keeping safe, and I hope you and your family are doing well at this time.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I'm doing okay so far. I've actually stayed away from my family. I'm still up in Edinburgh, which is where my training base is. I think that's the best place for me to, you know, be able to continue training as normally as possible. I think if I was back at home, I'd probably get distracted very easily.
Yeah.
But also, my parents are reasonably old now. You know, they're not so young anymore. So they're probably one of the more vulnerable group to this virus. So, you know, for me to be able to like avoid carrying anything and giving anything to them, I think that's a positive thing. So, you know, it's tough to be away for so long, but I think it's for the best.
Listen, talking about family, you've got this question many times, but for my listeners, your mother is Bajan, your father is Jamaican, you were born in England, and you chose Jamaica.
Yeah.
Why?
You know, it was a tough decision for me to make. I felt like I was choosing between, you know, my mum's side of my family and my dad's side of the family, which is obviously not a very nice position for many people to be in. But, you know, it was something I weighed up for a period of time. And I figured that just in terms of the sporting strength of each nation combined, you know, in comparison, Jamaica was much stronger due to the strength of track and field.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was really that attracted me to representing Jamaica. I felt like, you know, if I do go to competitions, I do go to games, and, you know, I have media opportunities and things like that, the Jamaican tracksuit looks, you know, it stands out more because of the track and field, you know, strength and the athletes that they have. So that was genuinely a part of my reasoning. I really didn't want to choose between my parents, but I think Jamaica was the obvious choice for me.
Talk to us about what they felt about that, though. Did they like, you chose that side?
Well, you know, they've never said that to me in person, especially the Bajan side. They've never told me what they really think about it. I'm sure that they're probably a little bit disappointed that I didn't choose Barbados, but, you know, family's family at the end of the day, and they wanted me to succeed no matter what, and they were just glad that I had made a good decision and a positive decision for me. And I'm glad that I can show them, you know, if they did have any doubts, I'm glad that I can show them that it has worked out really well, and it definitely was the right decision to make.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about family, and you're close to both mom and dad. How was that support system growing up in terms of just you participating in sports?
You know, as I've gotten older, I've really began to appreciate more and more the, you know, the job that my parents did to actually bring me up. And I think they did an amazing job to bring me up in the right way, guide me down the right paths, give me all the opportunities that I needed, but not too many where I became, you know, complacent. I think it's a very difficult balance to find. And it really makes me think about how, you know, hopefully one day I'll be a parent myself, and it makes me think about what I'm going to do as a parent, because, you know, I don't know if they did it on purpose or if it was just a complete accident, but they did an incredible job of just getting all the balance, you know, right for me. And I think that is a testament to the person that I am today. And it really makes me want to do the best that I can in, not just in diving, but in life. You know, they gave me so many opportunities with my education and things like that. And it makes me want to just do the most possible just to, and that's the best way I can say thank you for the sacrifice and the help that they gave me growing up, because, you know, I can never financially give back to them. That's never going to happen realistically. So the best way I can kind of, you know, say thank you is by actually doing the best I can in whatever it is that I try to do.
Yeah, and what you have decided to do is diving. Now, Yona, I mean, there have been several features all over the world about Yona Knight Wisdom in terms of he's not the typical diver.
Yeah.
You're taller than the average diver, more muscle mass than the average diver. You're a black person in the pool, which doesn't happen a lot.
Yeah.
Certainly not in diving. How have you managed that, both in terms of challenges and motivation?
Well, see, the thing is, my love for diving was set in before I started to grow. So I was already trapped in a certain way in the sport because I loved it so much as a kid. But you know, I was small, I was young, I was, you know, not as big as I am now. And then the growth came. So I guess I went through some difficult periods whilst I was growing because, you know, I realized that it wasn't an easy sport for a tall person to do. But I think it was just the general enjoyment which really kept me in it. So I think the motivation just came from that, you know, the combination of wanting to do well in whatever it was that I did because of the opportunities that I was given, and also just my love for the sport and how I enjoyed, you know, spending time with the friends that I had made, how I enjoyed learning new things in diving. And obviously it helped that I was actually doing quite well at it as well. I was very fortunate to be coached by some outstanding coaches from a young age. You know, I've kind of figured that success was pretty much guaranteed with those coaches as long as I was committed to it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I just had to give it my all, and I knew that the good things would come if I just committed.
Mm. Have you ever thought about switching sports? Was your time doing that, especially during that growth spurt, you know, that you thought like, listen, I may just need to change to cricket?
Well, the thing is, whilst I was growing, I wasn't only diving, I was also playing all the other sports as well at school. And as I say, I was at a great school and they had a really good sporting culture. So we had rugby in the winter, football at the start of the year, and then cricket through to the summer. So, you know, I got to taste all these different sports and see what I was good at. I also did like athletics and, you know, a few other things at school, but I wasn't as good at them as I was at diving, and I didn't enjoy them as much as I enjoyed diving. So, you know, it was like a process of elimination, really, based on enjoyment levels and based on, I guess, my ability. And both of those laid with diving.
Yeah. Yona, after the 2016 Olympics, you went to Liverpool, John Moore University, to do some tests, where they ran some tests on you. And one of the observations is the amount of power that you generate in terms of, you know, jumping and height and all of that. How has that helped you in terms of making adjustments from those assessments to now?
Well, they were, you know, just really interesting for me to hear personally. I didn't necessarily have to make any adjustments just because, you know, I was always aware of some of my strengths, and that was what me and my coach kind of tactically had to figure out based on how I was best going to compete, because I had to play to my strengths.
Mm.
You know, there's some divers that can get away with not playing to their strengths and taking a bit of a risk, but for me, that's less, you know, that there was less of a chance of me doing well with my height and with my size. So I always really knew my strengths, and doing those tests just confirmed it more than anything to me within myself. So the leg strength and power that I have, the amount that I can jump, and all of the other things that I got tested on, it kind of just confirmed it to myself what I knew I had, which was really good for my confidence, I think. So it allowed me to just trust in myself a little bit more. I think the surprise result that I got was the endurance one.
Right.
Because they got me to run on the treadmill for a period of time, and they measured, you know, all of my, all the physiological things within me. And it turns out that my endurance is actually really good.
Right. I did see that one. I was watching that video. For the listeners, you can check that out. It's on YouTube. I'll probably put in the show notes where you can find it. Yona, talk to us about some of the challenges that you have had in terms of just getting it right. I know there are points you were kind of concerned about just fixing out of those techniques. Talk to us about that and how you have managed to go through some of the tough period to where you are now.
You know, I think I've had to go through a lot in terms of just understanding about the sport and how best to compete at an international level. I think that's been my toughest challenge actually in diving, because, you know, when I decided to represent Jamaica, I had zero international experience, hadn't gone to any competitions, and had this ambition of going to the Olympics. And, you know, I had to go out to, you know, various competitions and just take the bad results. And that was fine because I knew it was just experience, and I knew that I was going out there just to gain the experience. It didn't really matter how I competed. It didn't matter if I, you know, did terribly or, you know, made a semi-final or final. I wasn't too bothered about that, and I had accepted that pretty quickly. So, you know, in the process of trying to qualify for Rio, I had to go through those difficult times to get to the good spot, and I feel like I did it perfectly. It worked out obviously really, really well. The real challenge after that was realizing that I was actually a good diver, realizing that I can compete against some of these, you know, some of the best divers in the world, because I've done it before, so there's no reason why I can't do it again. Mm-hmm. And then having that transition again into doing a few more difficult dives and having to get used to competing those dives in competition, when I actually expected myself to be pushing for that semi-final and be able to push for the final. And if I was in there, I could have a chance of getting the medal. But because I needed to build that experience on those new dives, quite frequently they would go wrong. So then that was extremely frustrating. And it really made me question whether diving was actually still the sport for me, whether I could still do it and keep up with some of the best divers in the world. Because my expectations, I think, were a little bit too high to where I was at that particular time post-Rio.
Let's talk about Rio then. So you qualified for the Olympics and you were at the Olympics. Before that first day of competition, how did you prepare for it? What was the feeling going out there on those board to make that first dive representing Jamaica at the Olympics?
As soon as you talk about it, it just makes me smile, because that's literally how my whole attitude was that entire 3 weeks I was in Rio. I was just happy. I was just so happy. You know, it was my dream from the age of 9. And just to be there and experience it, I was just happy. I was just having fun. I was taking it all in as much as possible, enjoying the situation, enjoying the environment, trying to control my excitement when I saw some of the, you know, some of the big athletes that I'd, you know, admired and watched for a number of years. It was just a good feeling. And it didn't really, I think one of the things that I was actually worried about going into the Olympics was kind of being overawed by the situation and by the, you know, the environment, just by the fact that there were going to be Olympic rings everywhere. You know, you're always going to see it. You're always going to know you're at the Olympic Games. And I didn't want that to kind of overwhelm me when I went into competition, but it didn't actually affect me at all. The only time that I really felt nervous and that I really, you know, I realized I was in the place that I was when I actually stepped on the board for my first dive. And I stood on the board and I remember doing what I would never normally do, but I stood there and just looked around at the arena. And, you know, we're normally used to competing in front of, like,
right,
not even 100 people. you know, we get to at nationals, we might get 100, maybe a little bit more. At the World Championships, if you make a final, you might get, you know, 1,000. But in Rio, there was like, I think the stadium was like 10,000, maybe a little bit more. And it was full. It was full, full. And I stood there and I looked around before my first dive. I was like, wow, I've made it to the Olympics. I'm here. Oh my God, I've got to do my dive. I was like, wow, do not mess this up now. This is your chance. You're here. You've made it. Don't mess it up now. And that's when the nerves really hit me.
Yeah, and you didn't mess up. You did well. What were some of the lessons that you took, certainly from that first major experience?
You know, I as you say, I did well. I was happy with the outcome. I was actually a little bit frustrated at the time because I knew I had more in me and I could have done better. But I think that just sits with my kind of athlete mentality of always wanting more, which is definitely a good thing. But had you told me, you know, a year or 2 years beforehand, before I'd qualified, that I would have finished 14th at the Olympics, I would have, you know, taken that with open arms for sure. Some of the lessons that it actually taught me was to just enjoy what I did. And it actually it took me a little while to understand the lessons that I learned from Rio. And it was just about enjoying what I do and understanding and appreciating that it's really a once in a lifetime opportunity and that it's something that I really shouldn't waste.
Right.
And, you know, as I said, I went through that difficult period kind of 2017, 2018, where I was expecting better results than I was getting. And that's because I thought, you know what, I'm an Olympian. I should be able to achieve these kind of things. But yes, I was an Olympian in 2016, but that means nothing in the years in between. And that means nothing when the next Olympics comes around.
Right.
You know, I've got to earn that spot once again. Nothing's given. So it really made me kind of switch my attitude, switch my focus, and, you know, switch the way I appreciated what I did every day.
Then we moved to 2018, the Commonwealth Games in Gold Coast, Australia. This was a big one also for Jamaica because we're having our top diver competing. What was that experience like for you? And again, what were some of the lessons for you there?
Yeah, that was another kind of, it felt like one that got away for me because, as I said before, you know, I had much higher expectations of myself post 2016. And at that Commonwealth Games, I really went into it knowing that I could win a medal. And that was my aim. That was my goal. And I was certain that I could do it. But, you know, it didn't work out like that. And I think, you know, probably the cliche thing to say is, you know, I thought about it too much and I was too excited about the prospect of getting the medal. I didn't focus on the process. But, you know, it was a turning point for me in that I knew I had to make some changes in my life to give myself that good opportunity. And, you know, that was not just in the diving pool, but also away from the diving pool, you know, how I conducted myself every single day, how much rest I was getting, what I was eating and drinking. And, you know, it really made, at the end of that season, once I had finished the season, it really made me think and change a number of things in order to put myself in a good enough position to actually make it to Tokyo.
Yeah.
So as difficult as what that was to go through, you know, I got fourth on 1 meter. So I wasn't far away from a medal by any means. And, you know, I've said it to many people, like, that I got fourth at a Commonwealth Games and like, oh, that's an amazing result. But actually for me, it wasn't. And it was, you know, something that should have been more. And I think it was shown the following day when I went on to 3 meter and I just scraped through to the final when I should have easily been qualifying for that final. And I only ended up ninth. I think had I won that medal on 1 meter, it would have been fantastic. And I probably would have carried that form through to 3 meter.
Right.
And I probably could have done really well there as well. But then looking deeper than that, it probably would have masked a few of the problems that I was actually kind of dealing with at that time. And masked some of the things that needed to be changed that I might not have changed, which would have negatively impacted the end of this cycle is in, you know, 2019-2020. So I'm kind of glad I went through it, as difficult as it was. I think it's resulted in very good things.
Yeah, I mean, I was at the finals, the 1 meter at Commonwealth Games. I mean, not to just bring up everything, I mean, you were doing really well. And, you know, the thing about diving I've learned is that it's about repetition.
Yeah.
If you're on that springboard, it's energy transformation, it's body in free space. And as you rightly said, I think most persons there also thought that you would have medal. I mean, yeah. The truth is, though, Yona, I think most persons who are certainly in the field believe that you're a big talent. And moving into the Pan Am Games now, I think you made some of those adjustments you talked about. Was coaching one of those that you thought you needed to make from the Commonwealth Games in terms of changing coaching, and what were some of the other adjustments you made?
Well, funnily enough, the change in coach wasn't actually my first thought. You know, I was actually more than happy in Leeds. I was really happy with the people that I trained with and the coaches that I had down there. And I thought it just needed a little adjustment in the way that we did things and, you know, more communication between the two of us to help improve it. And, you know, there may well have been a chance that things would have improved had we got everything set a little bit. But, you know, some of my older coaches, they suggested to me to make a change, which they thought would be much more positive in the future. And, you know, I made that big change to move up to Edinburgh, change coaches and, you know, just change the whole environment. And that was the main thing that I needed to change, the environment, because, you know, I'd dived in Leeds for 14 years. I'd seen so many people come and go from there. I knew exactly what to expect every single day. And that gets a bit stale and a bit stagnant. And sometimes you need to change the environment, which will spark something within you. And that's exactly what Edinburgh has done for me. You know, my new coach, Jen, she's been incredible. She's really pushed me to a different level that I've never pushed myself to before. And so she's brought some amazing things out of me. But I think taking her to one side, the environment more than anything, has just helped to freshen my mentality up and helped me to actually just enjoy every single day more than I ever was before. And that's what I've been doing. Like, every single day of training is fun. Like, I look forward to going to training just because it's fun. Like, I want to do well, I want to work hard, I want to train well, and I do that, but I'm literally laughing so much, I'm having a great time every single day. And that is so valuable, I think, to, you know, the quality of your training, which I think a lot of people miss. And I think I lost that a little bit in Leeds, unfortunately. Which is a shame, because, as I say, I loved Leeds and it gave me so much. So yeah, that was one of the major adjustments. And, you know, as you said, you were there in Gold Coast at the finals, and then you were also there in Lima in 2019 to watch the 1 meter, right? And I don't know what it'd be like from your perspective. It'd be quite interesting to hear it, but Could you see a difference in me and my mentality and my kind of attitude from Gold Coast to Lima?
Listen, the podcast on you is coming out, so you're now asking me questions. But no, it certainly did. And there's more composure, certainly in Lima, than in Gold Coast. And one of the things I noticed in Lima is, even when the other divers were putting up some incredible scores, that didn't bother you this time. You know, you still went out there, and even your lowest score, you know, last person thought it was still a good dive. But I think this time, let me say it another way, the crowd thought you should have gotten better scores on most of the dives.
Okay.
You know, and these are some of the top professionals. But what I admired this time more than ever was the level of composure. Just once you get on the board and execute it. And I think that for me was way better this time around. You know, it was just unbelievable composure.
And I think that's what the change in environment gave to me. because when I actually got onto the board, I wasn't worried about anything else other than the dive. I was more focused on the process of how to get that dive right. And, you know, I changed certain ways about how I competed. And this wasn't necessarily my coach suggesting this to me. This was just, it just kind of developed from the conversations that we had and what we thought was best for me and everything like that. And it was something that I, you know, decided to change, like to not look at the scoreboard and not worry about how many points I had earned from my last dive and how many points away I was from first place, things like that. I completely ignored that. I just focused on the process of the competition because that's really what she ingrained in me in every single dive, in every single training session, is just focus on the process. Think about the little details that you can change to potentially improve it. Don't worry about the outcome. Just worry about the little finite details. And I think that's what I took into competition, and that resulted in a lot of success in the competition as well.
One of the things I noticed, Yona, is so while everyone is competing, you have on your headsets, you're listening to something. I don't even know what that is. I probably will ask, you know. And then you go through a process of moving to your springboard, diving, getting out of the water. Headset is back on after you do your wash-offs. And you continue that process. You're not paying attention to anything. What is it that you're listening to? Yona, is what everybody wants to know. and how do you keep that relaxation going throughout? And I'm talking about especially Pan Am Games.
So I'll tell you like a little bit more in depth about my actual routine. So what I listen to is hip hop. I listen to hip hop music. The occasional bit of dancehall as well, just to switch it up sometimes, but. You know, hip hop is what I've been listening to for a long time, and that's just what I'm most comfortable with. And I think that's important. Just listen to something that you're comfortable with, not changing it too much. If music's a thing that someone, you know, goes to, because I value that so highly for my competitions. So, you know, I've created a playlist on songs that I really like and songs that I know, songs that I often know the lyrics to. And the main aim for me is just a distraction more than anything. So I don't want to hear what's going on with the competition. I don't want to hear the scores being read out for the divers, because that's going to make me want to look at the scoreboard. I don't want to hear the cheers of the crowd. I just want to zone into my music and listen to something that I enjoy. And between rounds, whilst I'm waiting, I often like have a game on my phone, depending on how long the break is between each dive. So for Pan Ams, because it wasn't too long, but it was long enough for me to actually sit down and do something. I was playing Sudoku on my phone. I was going to some Sudoku puzzles. Again, just as a distraction more than anything, just to keep my mind occupied whilst waiting. And then you spoke about the movements and the process from that point to actually getting on the board. And one thing that I learned pretty early on, I think 2013, 2014, is that it's extremely important to pretty much do a full warm-up before every single dive, because, you know, we're sat down, especially at the World Championships, where there's 50, 60 divers in the prelim. You know, you could be sat down for 30, 40, 45 minutes between each dive. Obviously, with Pan Ams, it was a little bit quicker, but, you know, it's important to carry that same process through. So that was just a process of warming my body up, getting my body moving, so that when I got on the board, I don't feel any kind of stiffness. I don't feel any kind of, you know, I don't feel like anything's off. So I'm ready to just go and do my dive as best as possible. Again, I think the length of the warm-up is actually, again, just another distraction to do something that occupies me, do something slightly different during the round, just to, you know, so I don't get bored more than anything.
The one question I've always wanted to ask you, and we've talked many times off here, and I've never asked it, how do you manage to concentrate, certainly on a 1 meter springboard, because you're one of the few or the only diver I've seen, when you hit that board, the board actually touches the water.
Yeah.
And you have to time the board again in terms of just making the dive. How do you do it?
Well, one thing in springboard diving is board rhythm. It's very, very important. And my first coach, he was one of the best at board timing. And he taught me really well how to time a board. And obviously we spoke about how I grew and got heavier and got bigger. And, you know, I can't remember what age I started touching the water at, but I've been doing it for a long time. I've been doing it for quite a few years now. Maybe even version on, let's think, probably about 7 or 8 years I've been hitting the water every single dive, even in training with the 1 meter springboard. So, you know, it's something that I'm used to more than anything. And it's something that, you know, you develop a little bit of resilience to it, I think, more than anything. So when it happens in competition, it's not actually something that I think about at all. Even though that's when most people see it. That's when most people are like, oh my God, you touched the water with the board.
Yeah.
Like, oh yeah, I actually forgot I do that. It just happened. I'm so used to it. But obviously, you know, the board on 3 meter without the water there, it moves down and up in, you know, a smooth rhythm, right?
Right.
Obviously on 1 meter now, it hits the water. So it goes down in the same rhythm as normal, hits the water and slows down a little bit to come back up.
Right.
So it's just an adjustment that I've had to get used to in terms of how I actually kind of apply the pressure and how patient I have to be on the takeoff into each dive. But it's manageable. It's challenging, but it's manageable.
And which one do you prefer, the 1 meter or the 3 meter?
No, I definitely prefer 3 meter. I've had generally better results actually on 1 meter.
Yeah.
In many aspects, you know, I made the world championship final in Guangzhou last year on 1 meter. I, you know, had better results at Commonwealth on 1 meter, better results at Pan Ams on 1 meter. So, you know, the better results, I guess, have more frequently come on 1 meter. However, I think 3 meter is more entertaining for me. It's more fun. It's where the real challenge is. You know, it's where all the best divers are. And that's where I really want to compete on.
Let's talk about training now, Yona. I'm quite sure diving doesn't look like a very cheap sport. How do you manage that? How do you manage in terms of, is it one of those financial costs, I should say, that is prohibitive? And how do you manage those costs to be competing at the highest level?
Financially, it's actually not as bad as you think it would be for diving as a sport. You know, all we need is trunks, really. At the end of the day, we just need swimming trunks. So it's reasonably simple. You know, my parents have always paid my training fees, and I've always wanted to not make them do that, but you know, I haven't had the kind of freedom to be able to do that. So I'm very fortunate that they're there to still kind of pay those fees for me every month to allow me to just train every single day. The main expense for diving is the travel and accommodation.
Nice.
So I was lucky enough to get Levi Roots on as a sponsor, Mr. Reggae Reggae Source, from, you know, based in the UK but a Jamaican businessman, and I was really lucky to get him on board from the start. I was actually reminiscing and looking over the initial emails that I sent out to him to get him to sponsor me, and you know, that has been, you know, my hard work has been there, my dedication and motivation has always been there, but without his money to send me to all the competitions that I went to gain all the experience that I did, you know, there's no way that I'd be in the position that I am now. So that is, you know, just unbelievable. But other than that, you know, day to day, just being able to live as well and as healthily as possible, that's a challenge. And you know, there's a few other pieces of equipment that I've purchased to help me train, but it's nothing too extreme.
All right, Yola, we've been talking a lot about your competition. Let us have now an idea of what is your daily routine. What happens on a day-to-day basis for you and the Night Wisdom when there's no lockdown?
So, yeah, not normally without lockdown, I spend a lot more time away from home than I actually do at home. So this has been a real adjustment to make. But I wake up around 8 o'clock. In the morning on a normal day. There's one day out of the week on a Tuesday where we train at 6 a.m. So I have a very early start and I have to take a nap after training. But, you know, that's a challenge, but it's nice to have, I think, once a week.
Ah.
But anyway, I wake up around 8 o'clock, have my breakfast, and kind of do some of my, you know, personal projects or personal tasks that I need to do, whether that's working on some of the podcasts that I've either recorded or, you know, need to get organized or things like that. Then I go and do my morning training session, which is usually strength and conditioning, which I do 3 times a week at the weights gym. That's around 1.5 to 2 hours. Then I come back home, I've got just about an hour back at home to have some lunch, not too heavy, just something to keep me going for my next session, which usually starts around 1:30. And I train at the pool now, which is a different location to where I do my strength and conditioning. We usually train for about 2.5 hours. So we have 1 to 1.5 hours in the gym and then 1 to 1.5 hours in the pool. Varies depending on what point in the season we're in. And then that's my training done for a day at around 4 o'clock. And then on Mondays, Wednesdays, Thursdays and Fridays, I have coaching after I finish training. So I'm still staying at the pool for another couple of hours, maybe 3 hours on top of that, and coaching my little group of divers. So finally, I'm then done for the day. It's usually around somewhere between like 7:30 and 8:30. I finish, come back home, have dinner, and chill out and go to bed pretty much. So I don't really have too much time to watch too much TV. I don't have a games console, so I don't play too many games. Although I kind of wish I did, because I quite enjoy like playing FIFA and things like that, but I haven't really had the time. And, you know, as I've said before, I want to put everything into what I do every single day, as much as possible. So I'd rather not, you know, I see it personally for me as a waste of time playing on games, because I'm not very good at them. So yeah. I'd rather not waste time on that and actually do things that I'm good at. So yeah, that's my general day, but each day is slightly different to the day before, because our training is at different times. As I mentioned, we have the Tuesday morning session. We also have a Saturday session at 8 o'clock in the morning. And we train, I stay at the pool the whole day until 2 o'clock, and we have like 1.5 hour break between the two sessions. Mm-hmm. Similar kind of concept on a Thursday, but it's a little bit later on. We start at 12:30 and we finish training at 6:30. So with the 1.5 hour break in between. So there's a lot of variation between the day, but it means that I have different times to do different things. So I have the Thursday morning free, so I can, you know, choose to have a bit of a line, or if I want to get up and go somewhere, I can do that in the morning. Or if I want to meet someone or record a podcast or something like that, I can do that on my Thursday morning, or, you know, another point where I've got a bit of free time. So, you know, I quite enjoy the variety. It keeps me on my toes.
You mentioned the podcast, The Athlete's Voice, mm-hmm. that you've started, and you have various versions of it, you know, talking about successes, challenges athletes go through. What made you start this podcast? And talk to me a little bit about that podcast, The Athlete's Voice.
So the podcast kind of came from a place of boredom a little bit. As you can probably tell with the conversation that we're having, I like talking, especially about myself.
that is completely fine.
But you know, it kind of all started post Rio. Once again, I mentioned Rio a lot. It really was a turning point in so many ways. But in 2016, I also graduated from university. I'd started there in 2013, so I was doing that alongside training the whole time. And I've always had, you know, school, some kind of education alongside training. I've always had something to kind of take my mind away from training every single day. And after graduating uni, I kind of lost that. You know, most people graduate, then go to a job and go to work.
Right.
So there's not really a normal path for someone who doesn't want to go into a job straight after uni. You have a lot of free time. And I wasn't enjoying the amount of time that I had away from training, because I didn't really have anything that I felt was productive to do. So I wanted to find something. I started off with YouTube and like making some YouTube videos, and that took my time and attention quite a lot, with the editing and having to think about the content that I was going to create in each video.
Right.
But I found it was a little bit of a distraction having the cameras at the pool and everything like that. And I don't know why, but my creative mind always seemed to wake up at about 10 p.m. So I'd be sat staring at my screen trying to figure out how I was going to edit this video. Then around 9 or 10 p.m., I'd figure it out and start editing and then get on a roll. And then I didn't want to stop. And, you know, the time would tick away. All of a sudden, it's 12:30, 1 o'clock, and the next morning I've got to be up early for a training session. So that wasn't good.
Right.
So I decided to kind of cut back on YouTube and stop making videos as much and focus on something different. And, you know, I'd heard about podcasting a little bit more, and there was a podcast that I listened to which spoke about why everyone should be podcasting. And I thought, you know what, I might as well give it a go and figure out a concept. And I decided to name it The Athlete's Voice because, I guess the concept was just athletes talking. So it was in very simple terms, an athlete's voice. But I wanted to give athletes the platform to talk about their stories and talk about their journeys that they've been on, you know, all aspects of it, not just the successes, but also the struggles and the difficult points, because that's where all the learning happens. As I've noticed many times in my own career, and you know, I've been on both sides of it. I've had the successes, you know, I got my silver medal at the World Cup in 2016, I got the Olympics, I've had the adulation from the media, but I've also had the other side of it where you feel like you put in a lot of work and you feel like you've done well. For example, my fourth place at Commonwealths, but you know, you get forgotten about very quickly because, you know, the media only really cares about the medalists. They don't really care about, especially fourth place. They don't really care about it because it's, you know, they say that second place is the first loser, but fourth place is the first real loser because you're not a medalist. Right. So it's pretty tough, especially when you put a lot of work into it and you don't feel that you get the recognition out of it. So I wanted to give the athletes the platform to, you know, share their stories as openly as they wish. So it took me a little while to actually figure out how I was going to go about getting those stories and the actual concept of it. But, you know, I played around with it and figured out the actual concept last year. So I've been getting, you know, episodes of what I call the worstest moments.
I've listened to a few of those.
Yeah, and you know, the worstest is a combination of the worst and the best. So I'll get them to tell me a story about the worst moment in their career and the best moment in their career and how they learnt from each moment and the contrast of, you know, their emotions and everything. And I think that is obviously the worst moments, I think, are where the most value is found. And it's quite often that the best moment comes not too long after the worst moment. Because I think sometimes you need to go through that dip to come out on the other end.
So let me just script on you then, and steal your idea for now. What would you consider your worst moment?
So this is something that I think about every single time I ask other athletes, and I really struggle to put my finger on the worst moment in my career, because I've had many difficult times. I think the worst moment for me. Man, this is actually hard.
You've been asking a lot of athletes that question.
I'm going through so many scenarios in my head, and I'm trying to find the one where I learned the most and I got the most value out of that situation. And I think I've got it. I think probably my worst moment in diving was at the World Cup in Shanghai in 2014. And all the times I've actually tried to been thinking about my worst moment, I've not picked up on this one, and it's just come to me now. And, you know, 2014, it was, you know, 2 years before the Olympics. So I was thinking, you know, I need to start trying to step it up and trying to push qualifying for a semi-final, because that's what my aim was. That's what I needed to get. And I went to Shanghai with the goal of trying to get within the top 25. I thought that would put me in a reasonable position to continue building on for the next couple of years. and I ended up finishing 31st with not a very good score, and I was super, super disappointed. And that time was the only time that I had actually cried out of sadness after a competition, and I just couldn't figure out why. And I was literally just sat in the stands after the event finished, and I just was getting really emotional within myself, and I was just sat crying. And you know, I put my headphones on to try and block out everything else so I could just get through that moment as quickly as possible. And you know, people saw that I was upset, so they'd, you know, a couple of people came over to me. I remember my good friend Chris Mears, he came over to me and, you know, put his arm around me and tried to have a little chat with me, and just get me back up, because you know, it wasn't really a big deal, but the more people that came to try and console me, the worse it got, and the more emotional that I felt. So it just kept on going for longer than I intended. I think if they just left me to it, I would have been over it in like 5 or 10 minutes.
Yeah. But, and I suppose what are some of the learning outcomes from that for you?
You know, it was, I think the learning that I took from it was how to actually conduct myself within the competition. There were a lot of things that I had to change in terms of getting ready for each and every dive, the warm up before each dive that I spoke about. You know, I didn't do it well enough. There were certain things that I needed to improve to, you know, compete well. It made me think about the dives that I was going to do and how we were going to play it tactically. Unfortunately, I still had another year to kind of play around with a few different dives and figure out what I was going to do for the World Cup in 2016 to give myself the best chance of qualifying. But I think it was the first time that I realized that it wasn't going to be as easy as I thought it was.
Yeah.
It made me realize that I really needed to put in some serious work and train every single day. In so many different aspects to, you know, give myself a good opportunity of competing well at the World Cup and qualifying for the Olympics in 2016. And it was quite funny, like straight after that World Cup in Shanghai in 2014, we were straight into the Commonwealth Games in Glasgow. And I actually competed really well at Commonwealth. And I think a lot of the emotion that I got out of me at World Cup and how, you know, horrible I felt then at that time, it was something that I just needed to get out, and I was able to just actually start relaxing and enjoying the competition rather than putting too much pressure on myself. And you know, I don't necessarily think that that was my worst moment, but it was definitely one of the worst moments of my career so far. I think if I gave it a little bit more thought, I could really pick on the worst moment, but but this was definitely one of the worst, for sure.
And I'm going to assume that your best moment is the Olympics.
No,
okay,
it actually wasn't.
Fair enough, which is why I'm going to ask that next question. Which one is it then?
So again, it's a difficult thought to figure out what my best moment was, but it was actually qualifying for the Games and the World Cup prelim in 2016.
Okay.
That was my best moment. You know, that day, what was it? I think it was the 21st of February 2016. For 4 years, that day was like D-Day for me. That was Judgment Day. That was what everything was aimed towards, that one particular day.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there were so many ups and downs, like I spoke about with the Commonwealth Games in 2014, that was a high, but the World Cup in Shanghai, that was a low. And, you know, it went on for the year following that. I had a really bad World Championships in 2015 where I was, you know, like 37th, way off where I needed to be. And I knew that the top 18 was the goal for World Cup. And, you know, I went there. There was only pressure from myself in terms of trying to achieve that top 18. I knew that I could do it. I knew that I'd put the work in and put myself into the best possible position to achieve that result. And, you know, I got there. A few things went wrong beforehand, you know, in the days leading up. My flight was delayed to get into Rio and I didn't get my luggage straight away. So do you remember the whole Zika virus thing going on at that time? On day one that I arrived at in Rio, right, I didn't get my luggage, so I didn't have a mosquito spray, and I got 4 bites on one shoulder from a mosquito. All right, and I thought I was guaranteed to get Zika virus because that was a transmission. Fortunately, I didn't. But that was just one of the things that wasn't quite straightforward. But, you know, on the day of the competition, it just went to plan perfectly. My coach always said to me, we wanted to try and hit 400 points. That was the aim. And I scored 397, so I was just a little bit below it. But it got me 17th place, and it got me my Olympic spot. And, you know, I mentioned that Shanghai was the only time that I ever cried because I was sad about diving. Well, this was the only time that I've ever cried because I was happy. And it was such a bizarre feeling. So it was just like a flood of relief and pressure off my shoulders. And, you know, I just felt better than I'd ever felt before. And, you know, all my friends came around to congratulate me. And it was just the best possible feeling. And the funny thing was, obviously, the next day, it was a semi-final. I competed well in that and progressed through to the final. Then I went on to win my silver medal, which my coach at the time, Edwin, he would always say that that was his best moment for me ever, the silver medal, because, you know, for me to get a world silver medal, that's unbelievable, yeah. Especially where I came from. Unbelievable. So for him, that was my best ever moment. But, you know, it's funny the difference in perspective in that actually getting the spot was my best moment, even though he said that that was never in doubt for him.
Right.
You know, he was always so confident that I would get it. It wasn't a surprise that I actually got it. But for me, that was where my best moment lay.
Yona, we now have, you know, just about a year plus for the next Olympics, but your training continues for qualifications.
Yep.
How will you, you know, kind of just manage yourself now to ensure that your nutrition stays the same way, your fitness level as best as possible, especially during this lockdown?
Yeah, I mean, I know how hard it is to get back to fitness after losing fitness. I get that feeling every single year in pre-season, and that's my least favorite time of the year. And I'm sure all athletes that listen can relate to that. Pre-season is definitely the worst time of the year. So, you know, now isn't the time to rest. Now is the time to kind of just continue as normal. We know that the Olympics isn't going to happen this year. Even though we don't have any more competitions for the rest of this season, I think it's important to just continue as much as normal, then take our break when we normally would.
Okay.
And then just start again next season in September, as we normally would.
Okay.
Because if I rested now and then had to try in September to get back to fitness, that's going to be worse than any other preseason I've ever experienced before. So that's really what's keeping me going. Kind of knowing that if I can maintain a certain level of fitness and conditioning now until the end of when the season would have ended, it'll benefit me going into the start of next season, and I'll be in a better place to compete well next year in February, which is when we think the World Cup's going to happen, and then hopefully in July when the Olympics happen, obviously depending on how long it takes for this situation to resolve itself.
Yeah. You're in the heights of your career now, Yona. At some point, you will exit the pool. After that last dive, what's next for Yona Knight Wisdom?
Yeah, that's something that I'm nervous about. I'm scared. I'm not scared, but it's something that's definitely in my thoughts. Something that I have learned, you know, post 2016 is that careers are very short. It happens, it comes and goes very quickly, and you know, you have to just enjoy it and appreciate it as much as possible whilst you're in it. So that's what I intend to do for the next few years. And then, you know, post diving, I'm still trying to figure it out, and I think I'm very fortunate in that I have the time to figure it out, because diving is, you know, it's given me enough, and, you know, I can potentially get more, definitely in terms of finances, I can get more to help me live more comfortably and things like that, and, you know, give myself more resources to train even better. But for what I've got at the moment, it's enough, and I'm content with that. And I'm happy with that for at least the next 4 years. And then, you know, when I get to 2024, I can reassess what it is that I want to do. You know, I might want to continue diving for even longer. I might be still in my peak then, you know, who knows?
Yeah.
I'm slowly figuring out the area that I'm most interested in. I mentioned that I went to uni and I graduated from my sports science degree with a 2-1. So, you know, that puts me in pretty good stead if I want to do a master's in any area. I think that psychology is an area that interests me a lot. So that could be potentially the area that I go into a master's with. When, I don't know, I could do it, you know, next year. I could do it alongside my training. But do I want that stress? I'm not too sure. it's a challenge. I've recently signed up with the Dame Kelly Holmes Trust, which was started obviously by Dame Kelly Holmes, the British middle distance runner. And she's got a trust which the main objective is to help disadvantaged youths, you know, just find more opportunities within their lives. And the trust uses athletes to be mentors and motivators to help these youths. And I've signed up as a athlete mentor, and I'm currently undergoing the training procedure to, you know, deliver sessions and deliver workshops and programs and things like that to help these youth. So, you know, that's going to be something that gives me a tremendous amount of value just within myself, and a load of experience learning from that. And, you know, I'd love to be able to just continue telling my story, because I think it's been a unique one. I think it's a story that a lot of people could hopefully find a lot of value from and learn a lot from. So, you know, if I get opportunities to do public speaking or, you know, talks and things like that to hopefully help other people, that's something that I'm very much interested in. You know, as I said before, I love talking about myself, and that's the perfect opportunity. If I can get paid to talk about myself, you know, that's the absolute dream.
Without giving out too much, Yona, what advice would you have for young divers? Not just in Jamaica, obviously, but in, you know, Barbados, in Leeds, in Edinburgh, wherever. What advice would you give to those young divers coming up?
You know, you mentioned Jamaica and Barbados, and obviously there's no diving programs as of yet, but I really do hope that what I can do in the pool now can spark something to happen in the Caribbean. Obviously, there's a facility in Trinidad. They've got a full diving setup, a really good one as well. And, you know, hopefully what I can do in the pool can, you know, help convince someone to invest some money into starting diving in Jamaica and in Barbados and other Caribbean nations. I really do think that Caribbean people can be talented in diving, even though the stereotype says otherwise. I think that we can be very talented in diving. So I hope that what I do every day and what I do in the future can help that. And, you know, once we do get divers, I think the advice that I would give to them is, you know, just to enjoy every single day and enjoy the opportunity that they get from it. Obviously, work hard, listen to your coach. That's the most you can do. Take ownership of what, you know, what you want to achieve, and make sure that every single day of your existence, you work towards that objective. And the more ownership you take over it, the more likely it is that you'll actually achieve that. But the most important thing is just to enjoy it. If you don't enjoy whatever it is that you do, whether that be diving or other sports, then, you know, you might be talented in another sport that you might enjoy more. So I think that's the key to any success, is enjoying what you do. So for me, I've been so fortunate to make some incredible friends and some incredible connections through diving. I've been incredibly fortunate to travel all around the world through diving, and hopefully I will inspire many others to, you know, be able to take some of the similar opportunities I've been able to take through the same sport in diving. So yeah, I hope that everyone enjoys what they do in it and that they're all happy in this sport especially.
Amazing. Iona, thanks very much for this. I really, really appreciate it.
Absolutely, it's a pleasure. Thank you very much for having me. And I hope I didn't talk too much.
No, man, it's been great.
Perfect.
So appreciate it. Remember, guys, you can follow Iona Knight Wisdom on Twitter. His handle is Iona KW. And it's the same one for IG. So you can go on Instagram. Also, check out his podcast. It's called The Athlete's Voice. And you can find it in any podcast directory. So that's for Iona Knight Wisdom. On behalf of our production team, thanks for joining us on this episode, as always, of The Drive Phase. Remember to check out our website. It's thedrivephase.com. Make sure to subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts. And I'll put a plug here for Iona's podcast also. Ensure that you subscribe to his podcast, whether it's Apple or it's Google Podcasts, Stitcher, so you'll never miss an episode. Remember, we'd appreciate a rating on Apple Podcasts or any podcast that you use. Go tell a friend about the show so they too can spread the word. Feel free to send feedback, comments, or questions to thedrivephase@gmail.com. Look us up on Twitter and Facebook at thedrivephase. You can always use the hashtag TDP. Until then, see you next time.